So I want to speak in answer to this question of what philosophy can tell us about life after death by working through 10 things that I think philosophy can tell us about human immortality. Now, my remarks today are going to be strictly philosophical. That is, they rely only on what can be known on the basis of natural experience that any reasonable human person can have. And I'm going to make no claims that rely on the truth of divine revelation or theology, though I am going to consider whether some such claims cohere with those truths that can be known by human reason. And my goal today is not to prove my conclusions, these 10 things, beyond all reasonable doubt. When I say that philosophy can tell us some things about life after death, what I'm saying is that philosophy can draw conclusions about life after death, which it's reasonable to hold, given certain experiences and certain ways of reasoning about them. I think probably all 10 of these conclusions are controversial, and there's a lot more that could be said about all of them. I'm probably not going to give an adequate argument for any of them, so I look forward to discussing them all with you during the Q&A. So the first thing philosophy can tell us about life after death is how we can go about inquiring into this issue. So obviously life after death is not available for direct empirical investigation, as Father said. And I'm not going to say anything about so-called near-death experiences, since there's too much uncertainty, I think, about what's actually going on there. And besides, those experiences are not available to everyone. Philosophy needs to begin its inquiry, I think, with current experience, an experience that's available to anybody. So what we need to do, if we're going to inquire into life after death, is consider whether we have any current experiences that transcend or occur outside of our bodies such that they could continue after death. Now, a fundamental principle for inquiring into life after death philosophically is given by St. Thomas Aquinas, and this principle is that action follows being. If you want to know what something is, look at what it does. And if you want to know what independently exists, rather than just being a property of something else, look at what acts, look at what does things. Effects reveal and fit with their causes. Now, we use this principle, action follows being, not just when we're thinking about immortality, but in everyday life and in the natural sciences. If we want to know a person's character, we observe their actions, and then we reason back to who they are such that they can act in that way. If a physicist wants to know the properties of some particle, she's going to observe what it does in a particle accelerator and then reason from those observed effects back to the unobserved causes, its structure. Now, Aquinas uses this method of effect-to-cause reasoning to discover what we, human persons, fundamentally are. In everything we do, in all of our experiences, we fundamentally change in certain ways, and we stay the same in other ways. So, for example, I eat and I respire, and I change the matter that constitutes me. I take on new beliefs, I abandon others, I make choices, I observe the world, I fall in love, I feel fear, and so on. And yet, through all of those changes, I experience myself and others experience me as the same person. When I die, the matter that constituted me is going to persist, right? But I will no longer be in it. Now, from these effects, we can reason that there must be something in me that changes over time, that remains when I go out of existence, that's the stuff out of which I am made. Call that matter. But there also has to be something else that remains the same, so long as I persist, that explains why I exist, why I am a human person, why I am organized in the way that I am with the powers that I have. Call that form. So form, this non-material part of what I am that stays exactly the same over time, explains why I am a human like other humans, but it's because I'm made out of this particular matter that my humanity is restricted to this particular place and time, and that I can receive particular effects from other material things and perform acts that have to do with material particulars. Because of their particularity, these acts, like sensing, feeling, imagining, they take place in matter, in my brain. But I also perform acts like thinking about universal concepts, concepts of kinds of things, abstracting from their particular instances. So I sense particular dogs or trees or chairs, but I think universally about what it is to be a dog, what it is to be a tree, what it is to be a chair. Now, we use universal concepts all the time in language, in formulating rules that govern our free choices. To sense something is to receive something of its form into my sense organs and thereby grasp a real, particular thing out there in the world. Likewise, to grasp a universal concept is to receive something of its form, the form of, say, what it is to be a human being, what it is to be a tree, a content that abstracts from all particularity and allows me to grasp that universal idea. Now, because of this abstraction, this move from the particular to the universal, Aquinas reasons, in that effect-to-cause way that I mentioned earlier, that thinking can't take place in matter. If thinking, and here I'm restricting thinking to thoughts involving universal concepts, if thinking took place in matter, then its content would be particularized, localized. But rather, it's universal. I don't just think about this particular chair. I think about what it is to be a chair, and I grasp a content that applies to all chairs in all times, in all places. Furthermore, while, barring synesthesia, we only see color and hear sound, we can think universally about any kind of thing. And we know that our minds are open to thinking about any kind of thing whatsoever because we can think about the kind being or existing thing, which is a concept that includes all other universal concepts. We do this when we engage in metaphysics. We think about being then, but we also implicitly do it all the time. Every substantial choice we make, every belief we take up, implicitly commits us to some position on what it is to be. If thinking took place in matter, say in the brain, then it would be restricted. But all these examples I've just given show that it is not. It is not restricted to thinking about particulars. Now, Aquinas knows that thinking is dependent on and correlated with sensory and neurological activity. We gather the content of what we think from the senses, and we use sensory examples to make sense of universal concepts. But the act and experience of thinking itself, the grasp and the processing of universal concepts, the act you're engaged in right now, cannot take place in matter. And since this act can't be in matter and action follows being, then there must be something in us that is non-material. Not just in the sense that the form that structures matter is non-material, every material thing has form in that sense, but in the sense of an immaterial part, a distinct thing that acts apart from matter. That which makes us human, our form or our soul, both gives structure and abilities to our body, and it transcends the body. Now, before I use this method and these conclusions to argue for the soul's actual immortality, we need to consider a few other things first. So the second thing that philosophy can tell us about life after death is what it means definitionally to say that the soul is naturally immortal. This means that the soul is immortal just by being what it is, without needing any additional gift or act, like faith or grace or performing some set of spiritual techniques or gaining some special knowledge. Rather, the soul just in and of itself is immortal. That's at least what it would mean to say that it's naturally immortal. I haven't argued for that. It is, in fact, immortal yet. To be immortal is to go on living. And to live is, minimally, to be able to change oneself, to act under one's own power. So to be naturally immortal is not just to be the sort of thing that goes on existing forever, but also to be able to live and act forever. To not be able to be killed or to die just by being the kind of thing one is. Now, given this definition of naturally immortal, we can look at the third thing that philosophy can tell us about life after death. And this third thing is a conditional claim. It's conditional because I haven't argued yet for the claim that the soul is, in fact, naturally immortal. So this third thing is that if the soul is naturally immortal, then the only way for it to cease existing would be for God to annihilate it. On many theistic views, including that of St. Thomas, creaturely beings continue to exist only if God conserves them. And the word conservation is one of the terms listed on your handout. What this means is that not only do contingent beings not explain their own coming into existence, right, nothing can cause itself to begin to be, but also they do not explain their continued existence from moment to moment. That I exist right now entails nothing about whether I'm going to exist one moment from now. All of my properties can be conceived without knowing whether or not they exist, just as we can conceive of a fictional character with all of his or her properties without that being existing. And so St. Thomas reasons that there must be something whereby I exist that's added on to my conceptualizable properties to make them real. So over and above the properties that I have that can be grasped in a concept, there must be an additional principle that makes them actually be. And he calls that the act of existence. That's also listed on your handout. And he reasons that since none of the conceptualizable properties of contingent beings explain or entail why they continue to exist from moment to moment, creatures must receive this act of existence from God. If my soul is naturally immortal, then on this view, that means that it's disposed to receive this act of existence perpetually. But on other theistic views, and on any atheistic view, once something has come into existence, then it goes on existing without God having to conserve it. John Bowdoin has called this the existential inertia view. So just as things continue in motion, unless acted on by an opposed force, so likewise on this view, things just continue existing on their own. These sorts of views generally reject the idea that existence is explained by this act of existence that gets added onto a being. Today I don't want to take any sort of stand on which of these views, conservation or existential inertia, is true. I don't need to take a stand on that to show that this third thing is something that philosophy can tell us. On either one, if the soul is naturally immortal, then the only way it could cease to exist is if God annihilated it. On the conservation view, this would involve God stopping giving it the act of existence. On a theistic version of existential inertia, God would have to do something to it to annihilate it, though I don't know what that would be. And if there's no God, then if the soul is naturally immortal, then there is no way for it to go out of existence. Now, in this same vein, philosophy can tell us a fourth thing, also a conditional point, about life after death. If there is a God who is rationally consistent and the source of things' natures, then it's unlikely that any soul is ever annihilated. And so all souls just continue to exist forever. The clearest natural reason I think that we have to think that there's a God is an effect-to-cause argument. Now, nothing about God is presupposed by the claim that the soul is immortal. And so I don't want to get too much into discussions of the existence of God. But the basic idea of this argument, probably many of you have heard it before, is that since contingent things don't explain their own existence, we can reason from these effects back to a first necessary cause. And since every property in an effect must already be in its causes in some way, otherwise the causes wouldn't explain where the properties of the effect came from, nothing can give what it doesn't have, all the perfections in creatures must already be in God in some maximally perfect way. Now, since God, on this hypothesis, is the ultimate source of created intellects, minds, then God has to have intellectual properties in some maximally perfect way. Being intellectual obliges one not to contradict oneself. And so if God is maximally perfect, then God's never going to contradict himself. Now, if God created things with certain natures and then thwarted those natures, he'd be contradicting himself. Now, bodily things, material things, naturally go out of existence. So God does not contradict himself if he allows a bodily thing to die or causes it to die. But if the soul is naturally immortal, then for God to annihilate it would be to thwart its nature and thus to contradict himself, which is impossible. Now, this is certainly a defeasible argument. I think there's probably lots of things that could count against it. We can talk about those in the Q&A. But that's why I say that if there is a God, it's unlikely that any soul is ever annihilated. Okay, I'm now in a position to turn to the fifth thing that philosophy can tell us about life after death, which is that human souls actually are naturally immortal. And I want to consider three arguments for this claim. These arguments are based on arguments given by Thomas Aquinas, and they also have roots in Plato and the Platonic tradition. So first, I want to consider a probable argument for the soul's immortality by an analogy between the soul and bodily organs. Okay, keep that principle I mentioned earlier in mind. Action follows being. Effects reveal their causes. If something acts, then it subsists. That is, it exists in itself or exists per se. That term is on your handout. So it has to exist, it has to be a thing, so that it can act. Now, our organs act. For example, the heart pumps blood, the hand grasps, and so they subsist. They exist in and of themselves. Likewise, my soul thinks, for the reasons we've already seen, and so it subsists, even right now, like an organ transcending my body. Now, subsistent things generally can exist on their own, given the right conditions. Aquinas thinks that our organs cease to be unified acting things when they are separated from the body. So he thinks if you chop off your hand, then it's no longer a hand. But I think we've got good reason to doubt that point of Aquinas's, based on organ transplantation. Given the right conditions, my heart or my hand or some other organ retains its unity, its activity, its subsistence, even when it's severed from my body. Hence, my heart can be transplanted functionally into somebody else's body. Okay, so because of this, I think there's a good inductive case that subsistent things can exist on their own even when they're separated from wholes of which they were parts, given the right conditions. By analogy to my organs on this argument, my soul could, given some set of sustaining conditions, continue to exist severed from my body. Okay, that's a first probabilistic argument. Second, I want to turn to a more demonstrative argument for the soul's immortality. Unlike our organs, the soul is an immaterial form. Form, as we've seen, gives existence. It's what makes a material substance exist as a particular kind of substance. Now, in non-intelligent material substances, say animals, plants, things like that, form is just that by which the substance exists. It's not a subject of action, not a thing that acts, and so not a thing that exists or subsists in its own right. But because it's the subject of thinking, the human form subsists. It has existence in itself, and then it bestows existence upon the body. Now, things cease to exist under one of two conditions. First, a thing can gain so many properties contrary to its nature that its matter can no longer be structured by its form. So, for example, my body will die if it's broken down by disease or injury, which are properties contrary to its nature, to the point that my matter can't support life anymore. Second condition under which something can cease to exist, a thing can stop being preserved by its sustaining causes. For example, my body will die if it's placed in a vacuum, where sustaining causes like oxygen aren't present. But neither of those conditions can befall my soul. First, the only properties my soul can gain are acts of thinking, willing, feeling, remembering. All my other properties, all my other acts, belong not to my soul, but to my body. Now, none of those properties, thinking, willing, and so forth, are contrary to my soul's nature. My soul's nature is to be open to any act of thinking, willing, feeling, remembering whatsoever. So none of them could break my soul down, so to speak, to the point that it could go out of existence. Second, my soul, being immaterial and subsistent, is not sustained by any material thing. And we've already seen that the only preserving cause that it might have, God, would very likely not cease preserving it. So barring the remote possibility of annihilation by God, and reasoning just on the basis of current experience, we can conclude that the human soul cannot be destroyed. The third argument I want to consider is one that I take to be a bit more controversial. Aquinas argues like this. Every being tends to preserve itself in existence in its own way. It has something like a natural desire or orientation towards continued existence. In non-conscious beings, say plants and stars and things like this, this desire or orientation towards self-preservation is something innate. It guides action without their being aware of it. In animals, this desire, I mean non-human animals, this desire is conscious. Non-human animals can't think about existence in itself or existence in perpetuity, so they don't have the desire to exist forever. Rather, they only desire to continue existing from moment to moment. But we human beings can grasp existence in itself and existence in perpetuity. And Aquinas argues that our natures are constituted such that when we grasp those kinds of existence, we automatically desire them. So it's a natural desire that is elicited, that arises as soon as we understand those ideas. Now, Aquinas thinks that no natural desire can be in vain. That is, having a natural desire is a sure sign that its object exists and can be attained, assuming that the world is coherent and divinely ordered. Now, I'm skeptical of this argument. I think philosophical reasoning needs to always begin with what's given in experience, and I think there's strong experiential reason to deny this argument's premise that when a human being grasps perpetual existence, he or she automatically desires it. Many people just don't want to exist forever, or they do want to go out of existence. Others, like Bernard Williams, hold that flourishing requires that life come to an end, because life's transitoriness gives it some of its deepest pleasures and is one of the greatest spurs to developing moral virtue, and that perpetual existence, he says, would be unendurable. Now, I think it would be condescending and indefensible to claim that these people haven't really grasped unending existence, or that deep down inside they do want to live forever. The medieval Franciscan philosopher John Duns Scotus argued, in effect, that because of the variations in desires among different persons, and because our self-knowledge is skewed by our many desires, we can't really determine, just on the basis of experience, which of our desires is a natural desire. And so we can't use purported natural desires to argue for their object's existence. Purported natural desire might just be wishful thinking or a projection of one's hope or fear. Rather, I think the reason to think that our soul is naturally immortal is that second argument that I gave, that it follows from the structure of thinking and other acts, not necessarily because of what we desire. That argument holds whether or not there is a God and whether or not natural desires can be in vain. And so I think it's a much stronger and more certain argument than the argument from natural desire. Still, I think something like Aquinas' argument from natural desire can be salvaged, at least as an argument for the plausibility of immortality. And I want to argue for this drawing on some arguments from the 18th century philosopher Immanuel Kant and from the contemporary phenomenological philosophers Emmanuel Levinas and Jean-Luc Marion. Kant argues that being rational and free requires me to strive for what he calls holiness. By holiness, he means a state in which I always act in a rational, self-determined manner without any feeling of being constrained by my duty. Now, this is impossible during our current life, our bodily life, when we're always swayed by bodily desires rather than being perfectly self-determined, and we always feel duty to be constraining to some extent. The call of freedom to holiness requires continued moral progress beyond this life, and so requires immortality. Now, this is not an argument that we are in fact immortal, but it's an argument that the experience of freedom's orientation to or innate desire for holiness indicates that it should be able to continue, and so we ought to be immortal. Levinas does not argue that we are immortal, but he does argue that we are called to infinite moral responsibility. So he argues that when I see the face of another person, I see someone whom I can't control, who's free, and who is threatened with suffering by my self-serving actions, and whose suffering I have always not done enough to alleviate. The other's face requires a response from me. I can't regard it just as a neutral object, like a chair, to be inspected at will. Rather, my response to another person's face is always morally charged, whether it be one of care or indifference or violence, it always has some moral connotation. The other's face calls me to endless responsibility. At no point have I definitively done my duty to others. Now, Marion links this to immortality. He argues that in seeing another's face, I receive a moral call that would require endless time to fulfill. And so it requires immortality, just as on Kant's argument. This is, again, not exactly an argument for immortality, but it's an argument that if the world is a coherent, divinely ordered place, or just if ethical responsibility is something truly foundational to human life and not just a sentimental illusion, then it's evidence for immortality. These arguments from Kant, Levinas, and Marion, I think, help us grasp the sixth thing that philosophy can tell us about life after death. Why many people, like Bernard Williams, have an aversion to life after death. As I've said, many people think that if life were endless, then we might always defer moral action, or we might evade responsibility altogether, looking forward to a happy afterlife with no responsibilities. Now, I think that if the evidence given by Kant and Levinas and Marion is at all plausible, then such a view of the afterlife must be rejected. We should desire immortality not as a state of endless duty-free pleasure, but out of an infinite desire for goodness and holiness. Aversion to immortality should be seen, I contend, not as a foundation for virtue, but as an evasion of responsibility. To hold that life definitively ends is to take myself as able to eventually get off the hook with respect to serving other people. Okay, given the content of everything I've said so far, we can turn to a seventh thing about philosophy can tell us about life after death. What kinds of experiences are available to the soul separated from the body? And I'm going to refer to that as the separated soul. Now, even if you've found my arguments for immortality unconvincing, you can still consider the arguments I'm about to give as being for claims about what the soul would experience if it were immortal. So you can just tack on that conditional if you didn't like any of my arguments so far. Now, only experiences that take place just in the soul during this life could be available to the separated soul. Things that we do in our bodies right now are not things the separated soul could do later on. A separated soul could think about abstracted concepts, for example, but only insofar as this doesn't involve sensory aids. It could make free choices, but only insofar as these are guided by abstract concepts. It could be conscious of its own acts and have feelings that follow upon thinking, like charitable love or spiritual joy or prideful hatred. But it could not imagine or sense material particulars, because those acts are in the brain, at least insofar as those acts are in the brain. Now, philosophers have disagreed as to which experiences are in the soul and which are in the body. And a key debate on this point took place in the Middle Ages between the Dominicans and the Franciscans. Dominicans, like Thomas Aquinas, tended to hold that the soul was weakened without the body. They reasoned that most acts require the body because the soul naturally draws knowledge from the body, from the senses. And without the body, it lacks sensory memories and the ability to naturally gain new knowledge. They held that it can only gain new knowledge if that knowledge is infused into the soul by God or angels or other separated souls. So the soul after death requires a community. The separated soul can be happy, Aquinas thinks, in seeing God, for example, insofar as this satisfies the human desire to understand. But the soul is not happy in every respect, for it is incomplete without the body, and it longs to be complete. Franciscans, like St. Bonaventure and Blessed John Duns Scotus, agreed about these claims about happiness, and they likewise held that souls are in community, but they held that the soul is not weakened by losing the body, even though they did hold that it longs to be reunited with the body. They reasoned like this: the soul can do everything when separated that it could do when embodied. It's not changed by the body's death. It was able to think when in the body, it can think out of the body. Furthermore, they held that the soul can abstract new knowledge directly from material things without bodily sensation. So they held that if it can abstract from things in the brain during this life, it can abstract directly from things out there in the world. It's just two different material things. They also held that the separated soul can remember sensory events that happened during embodied life, since it can retain concepts and propositions about what it did while in the body. Now, I don't intend to settle this debate here. The crucial point for my purposes is that whatever we do now that transcends the body, whatever you think that involves, is something that could continue after death. And furthermore, given what the soul is, it cannot be entirely fulfilled in every respect, without the body and without a community and without the possibility of ethical action. So, for example, the soul cannot be fulfilled in every respect if it were to engage only in intellectual contemplation, as on some accounts of the beatific vision of God. Souls are by nature forms of bodies, and so they're oriented to being united to a body and acting in matter. Hence, the separated soul would always desire the body and would not be fulfilled in every respect without it. Our intellects and wills, as we've seen, are called to infinite moral responsibility. So even if the separated soul were given the most pleasing contemplative experience of God, one which entirely fulfilled our intellectual desires and brought them to rest, it would still be oriented to perform ethical actions, to communicate goodness to other persons. And that requires a community with other finite persons. Given our orientation to communal, ethical, and bodily action, a fulfilled afterlife cannot consist, I would contend, of unchanging contemplation. Rather, it would require endless action and development, which some, following St. Gregory of Nyssa, call epectasis. So philosophical inquiry into human experience excludes certain theological claims about what life after death is like, as it would exclude certain accounts of the beatific vision. It's not possible that those be true, given the structure of human experience and human action. But I think philosophy cannot tell us whether the soul after death is in fact happy or rewarded or miserable or punished. For that, I think we need to turn to divine revelation. Moral acts in this life seem to merit reward. Immoral acts seem to merit punishment. But, on the other hand, each person is also called to infinite moral responsibility. So I think it's consistent with what philosophy can discover about life after death that separated souls be punished or rewarded, either temporarily or eternally. But alternatively, it's consistent with philosophy can tell us that they enter a situation where they're required to discharge their infinite moral responsibility. I don't think we can know, on the basis of current experience, which of those possibilities is right. Philosophy also, I think, can't tell us whether the soul's desire for the body will ever be actually fulfilled. But this is the eighth thing that philosophy can tell us about life after death. Reuniting with the body is at least possible and would be fitting to the soul, since the soul, as a form, is essentially ordered to informing matter. Philosophy can't tell us how this possibility could be fulfilled. We don't know of any natural process by which souls can reinform matter after death. But philosophy can't exclude, I think, the possibility of, say, reincarnation or resurrection. Peter Geech has argued against the possibility of reincarnation on the grounds that any apparent memory or connection to a past life, which is the only evidence we might have for linking our life to a past life, is unreliable, because memories are unreliable. But I don't think this is an argument against the metaphysical possibility of reincarnation, only against certain evidence for it. Others have argued against resurrection, that this would require that the soul re-inform the same matter it had during this life, given that my soul is the form of this matter. And furthermore, the fact that the same matter can be had by many persons, many beings over time, would count against the possibility of re-embodiment, since there seems to be no possibility of getting back that exact same matter at the end of time. But this also, I think, does not exclude the possibility of resurrection, even if we grant the objection. Re-embodiment need not involve the same matter in which one died. My matter is just whatever matter is informed by my soul, and that changes all the time. The soul desires matter, but not necessarily this matter. Plato argued that we long to be separated from the body, since the body distracts and distorts our thinking. But this can't rationally be a desire to exist apart from matter altogether. The 17th century Scotist philosophers Bartolomaeus Mastrius and Bonaventura Belluto argued that what we should intellectually desire is to be away from this body and in a better and more glorious body. Now, given how the soul needs the body, or seems to need the body, say for sense perception, the 20th century theologian Karl Rahner argued that the soul can never be separated from a body. Rather, he contended that immediately after death, the soul enters a resurrected body. And others, like Dante, held that the soul after death fashions a temporary aerial body prior to receiving a glorified body at the resurrection. Now, I think philosophy can't definitively show that these views are false. But what it can show, and this is the ninth thing it can tell us about life after death, is that it's possible for the soul to exist and to act separated from any body, continue to exist on its own in a disembodied state. And there are at least two experiences we have right now that count in favor of this claim. First, our current experiences of abstract conceptual thinking show that we already have a part that acts and so can exist apart from the body. So there should be no reason that it can't continue after death. Second, we experience other people to die. So while it's logically possible that their souls are immediately transferred to another body, somewhere else, that sort of view, as Matthew Levering has argued, doesn't do justice to the experience of seeing another person die. More in keeping with this experience is the claim that the soul leaves the body and then exists apart from a body. Okay, now to turn to my last point. Throughout this paper, I've been talking about the immortality of the soul. But you might be wondering whether the immortality of your soul is the same thing as your immortality. That is, whether the immortality of the soul suffices for the immortality of the whole person. The term person here refers to an intellectual subject of acts and existence with a complete nature and that is incommunicable. That is, that belongs, persons and acts belong to themselves and are incapable of becoming part of another or being assumed by another. Now, most of the medievals, including Aquinas, Bonaventura, and Scotus, held that while the soul survives death, the person does not. Aquinas says, for example, that when we pray to the saints by name, so if I say, for example, Saint Peter, pray for me, this is really just a figure of speech. Really, the person doesn't exist anymore. Only his or her soul exists, and since that was the saint's most principal part, we call it by his or her name. So it's cumbersome to say, soul of Saint Peter, pray for me, so we just cut it short and say, Saint Peter, pray for me, even though he doesn't actually exist right now. The separated soul preserves the person's existence, intellectual powers, and formal identity, such that if that soul reinformed matter, as at the resurrection, the whole person would come back into existence. So St. Peter will exist again one day, but doesn't right now, on Aquinas' view. Since, they reason, the soul is a part of a person, and human nature is rational animality, and animals are material things. So complete human nature requires matter, and since a person has a complete nature, then the soul apart from matter cannot be or constitute a person. That's their argument. This view is known in the contemporary literature as corruptionism. And it's been opposed recently by survivalism. On survivalism, I, this person, survive death, either identical to or constituted by my soul. And I contend that, this is the 10th thing I think philosophy can tell us about life after death, not only the soul, but also the person survives death. That is, I think philosophy can tell us that survivalism is true and corruptionism is false. The separated soul is certainly an intellectual subject of acts and existence. It can continue to think, so it's intellectual. Now, if it is not a person, then no one thinks its thoughts. The soul goes on existing, but if there's no person there, then there's no one thinking those thoughts. And I think that the notion of thoughts being thought by no one is incoherent. I think it's better to hold that the person is still present, in the separated soul. Furthermore, the existence of the separated soul is not just the existence of a part, like an organ, but since the soul is the form of the human person, its existence is the existence of the whole person. Now, a thing exists as a member of a certain kind, and to have the existence that belongs to that kind requires that one be a member of that kind, that is, have its nature. If the separated soul has the existence of the human person, then it must be a member of the kind human person and have the nature of human persons. That is, all of human nature, all of what it is essentially to be a human person, must be in the soul and must not require a body. In order for you to persist, you just need your soul, not matter. But our souls are also forms. And so, as Alison Thornton has argued, they are normatively embodied. It's the natural, non-debilitated state of the human soul to inform matter. Most human powers and acts, full human flourishing, require matter. So the resurrection is still very, very important. The corruptionist alternative is to hold that my existence, identity, and acts can go on without me, and such a view is, I think, at best, poor reasoning from the experiential facts, and at worst, incoherent. Okay, so over the course of this paper, I've tried to provide some reasons for holding 10 things that philosophy can tell us about life after death. My reasons and my conclusions are, as I've said, controversial, and we certainly haven't had time to delve fully into any of them.